They're a little more. So yeah, you can buy Jaws, or you can buy the Criterion Channel Jaws. Hey.
Yes.
7 o'clock. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. It's 7 p.m. Did I say it was 7 p.m.?
You did, okay. And I'm glad you did, yes.
It's still 7 p.m. in a little bit. Now, I listened to this the station called CFRC 101.9 FM, and sometimes the station break, a lot of the time, I'll hear, we're broadcasting from the basement of Carruthers Hall. I don't like that.
I just thought we were in the best part of the building. No problem. The wind can go by and not affect us.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Earthquake and no
problem.
They say the
basement as though it were...
No, it's a nice spot. It's
I don't
warm.
Think so.
It's
I don't
comfy.
Like it. I don't like it, Doug.
Okay.
They can just say...
No, I don't like them saying
they
that.
They can just say Carruthers Hall.
That's right.
Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. Why be specific?
Well, you can be more specific. It's like 62 Fifth Company Lane or something like that.
Whatever it's called.
Yeah. Yeah. Guess we're going to have to look that up.
I have to call Ed.
Oh, right.
Ed was the only one that knew.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is such and such. Yeah. But... Our parking lot has a name?
Yeah. 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 Especially on the tickets they give us.
Yeah, they definitely have those.
They give the exact location. Yeah. Anyway.
This is where we caught you.
Right.
Breaking the law.
We have a number of things in this hour on Aboriginal Voices, so I'm not sure if we're going to be able to get them all in tonight.
No.
We've got some requested music, so we'll get that up and running. But also, we have a special interview with, or a talk by Bob Watts. Do you remember him?
I do, sort of.
Yeah, he was, for a long time, he was with AFN. He was sort of in the background with administration of the Assembly of First Nations. And he's been working with universities and supporting many of the programs that are happening right now around Canada, right across Canada. And I see there he's an adjunct professor.
He's an adjunct professor.
Okay. That means that he's... He goes in and he teaches courses throughout the years, but he's not as a full professor.
So he's a supply teacher.
No. He actually is given courses to teach, but it depends on how many students are going to be taking that course. It's all supply and demand. But as an adjunct professor.
Supply teacher.
No. It's the demand part.
It's the adjunct professor part.
That's right. No, it's a good...
Makes more money.
It's a good
spot. That's awesome.
Because it gives you time to go and decide, I'm going to work on other projects. Okay? So we're going to have his talk.
Says here that he served as a chief of staff for the National Chief of Assembly of First Nations. Mm-hmm. Phil Fontaine.
Right.
Twice. Yeah, that's right. He was in there twice. Mm-hmm.
No, he's a good speaker. So I went to the talk, and I thought, well, this is going to be really good. And so I want to share it with everybody tonight. And we have a couple of songs we're going to play, and a bit of music and news about CFRC, right?
Sure.
And then we'll be all set. Hey, I do have to remind people that our annual Christmas Bake Off. December, it's the second Tuesday in December. Yeah. So I looked it up, December the 9th.
You can set your clocks by our annual Bake Off or calendars. Maybe you can set your calendars.
Well, I'm saying that right now because I'm just warning the folks who get our great big wood pile ready.
Yeah. Hurry up.
The leaves are still on the trees. We can't cut down some of the trees. No.
Cut them all.
No way. Hey, we're not doing that. But we do have some of the trees that came down last spring and early summer. You know, we had those big windstorms and many of the, especially the dead ash trees. So it looks like we might have a fair bit of ash that we could use, but there are some maple trees that came down as well. So we've got a stock right now, but we're going to set it up so that we'll have things ready. And I'm also just letting you know that you have to plan what you're going to bake this year.
I don't know, Doug.
Me neither. So that's funny. That's why I brought it up. I wanted to get ideas from you to see what I could do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We'll have a chat afterwards.
All right.
I'm sure Wendy will have a couple of suggestions
here,
for
us. Here, make this. Yeah. Wendy can participate.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. You know, not like Tuan did all those years ago when we got started.
No. She'll make it herself.
Oh, okay. No, but Tuan... Yep, participated in our bake-off, but it was his mom who delivered it.
And it was fantastic.
It was fabulous. So
fantastic.
Maybe
we should come back again.
Wendy could do that for us.
She could,
instead of us doing all the baking.
Oh, look, Aboriginal Voices is on.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it says right here.
It's on the air right now?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
We should play it.
No, not right now.
No?
No.
It'll be fun.
No, because it'd be like echoing.
I know.
It'll be quite.
That'll be fun.
Reverb completely.
We should play it.
No.
The folks at home want us to play it.
Are you ready? This is a song called "Take the High Road," and it was a song. Yeah, you laugh.
All right.
I picked this all a while ago, but it's a song by Nelson Little, who's from Manitoba. You all set?
Yeah. Go.
Against the wall, I'm holding my head up so I don't fall. No, it ain't too late, we ain't too far gone, 'cause there's more love than hate, and there's more right than wrong. So won't you sit right here beside me and rest your weary head, and let those sleeping dogs lie in someone else's bed. Putting the fight down, taking the high road out of town, taking my mind off the fight side, walking away, walking the line. No, it ain't too late, we ain't too far gone, 'cause there's more love than hate, and there's more right than wrong. So won't you sit right here beside me and rest your weary head, and let those sleeping dogs lie in someone else's bed.
Calling all AMS members, CFRC 101.9 FM is aiming to renew its optional student fee at referendum this fall. Help your campus radio station serve our community with news, music, arts programming, podcasts, and more. Watch your emails for ballots from the AMS and vote yes for CFRC's fee increase on November 12th, 13th, and 14th. Your voice, your station, your vote. Thank you for your support.
With Open Mouths, the podcast is hosted by Conita Lilla, Associate Curator, Art of Africa at Agnes Etherington Art Center. She sits down with artists, musicians, curators, and spoken word poets to discuss the expressions of their practice. She finds out how they found their artistic voice, which life events shaped them, and who their inspirations are. Find new episodes on Digital Agnes, CFRC's website, and on your favorite podcasting platform. Subscribe now and join us for moving and inspiring conversations.
My name is Genevieve, and I'll be hosting Peace, Love, and Jenny on CFRC 101.9 FM on Saturday evenings at 8 p.m. We'll be exploring everything from pop and soul to funk, jazz, and even a touch of hip-hop. Music that spans decades but all connects through good vibes, peace and love, and of course, a little bit of me, Jenny. See you there!
Your library, your story. At the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, books are just the beginning. A library card starts a lifelong adventure, connecting you to everything you need to inspire learning, creativity, and fun. With 16 locations and plenty of online services, using your library has never been easier. Study in a quiet space, meet friends and learn new things, or explore the world through a magazine or a museum pass. Become a part of our story. Visit your local library branch or find us online at kfpl.ca.
Well, thank you very much for that overly generous introduction. I see they gave you the long bio and not the 30-second bio, so I apologize for that. But thank you indeed for that introduction. Bonjour, Sego, Kanoshinwake Magazine, Indishnikos, Makwadodam. So my name is Tallpine. I'm from the Bear Clan, but you can call me Bob. I'd like to recognize the indigenous people of the territory that we're in particular the Mohawks of Tandanega, but this area has served as a crossroads for a lot of indigenous people for many, many centuries. So Ojibwe people think of this as part of their homeland too. So this area has been important for indigenous people for many, many centuries. This idea of recognition of the territory that you're in isn't just a matter of nicety or even a matter of sort of protocol. It really comes down to respect and honoring the people that have inhabited these lands since time immemorial. We witnessed this in 2010, probably one of the highest forms of respect that I've seen given in Canada or internationally, when Canada welcomed the world to Vancouver for the Winter Olympics. And there's four host First Nations that live in and around Vancouver. And so they were part of the official welcoming ceremony to welcome people from around the world. The Olympic Committee gave them the status of a nation state in terms of welcoming the world to Canada. And to me, this was, it was incredible. I remember watching this on TV, the opening ceremonies. There was Indigenous dancers from many, many of the cultures and nations in Canada that danced in, the athletes from around the world. My daughter, youngest daughter, and my oldest grandson were two of those dancers. And so I bawled my eyes out watching that incredible beauty and that incredible ceremony. But it seems like in some ways that sort of singular moment in terms of recognition of Indigenous people in Canada may have been just a moment in time. It may have been part of a nexus or part of a crossroads in terms of how we might think about each other differently. It might have been, and it might be, a way of thinking about reconciliation in terms of honor and respect. I think some of those ideas, some of that chapter is yet to be written, but I think in a retrospective way, it was incredibly symbolic and incredibly instructive in terms of how we can look at each other and how we can treat each other in a more respectful way. We're in a very, very interesting time right now. We've just had the release of a significant report from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the summer, this call to action, 94 recommendations that touches on every part of life in Canada. So whether it's government, whether it's federal, whether it's provincial, whether it's individuals, whether it's sports, whether it's business, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, there's a recommendation for each and every one of us, and the institutions and organizations that form part of our lives. But we've also just had the 250th anniversary of the Royal Proclamation, which really set the constitutional and Crown Indigenous framework for settlement in Canada. Have just passed the 400th anniversary of the Two World Wampum, which is considered in some ways sort of the grandfather of all treaties in North America, which set up the relationship between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people, sort of talking about that respect, that we all are traveling together in the river of life, but we need to respect what's in each other's boats or in each other's canoes, because we're bringing with us our own laws, our own culture, our own ways of spirituality, our own family structures, our own notions of diplomacy and governance. And we need to be mindful of those things and to respect those things. And as we travel together down that river of life, that we're going to have many exchanges with each other, we're going to have treaty with each other, but we also need to be mindful and respectful that there's different gifts that we all bring to sort of this party of nation building. We've just passed the 31st anniversary of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, in particular for Indigenous people, Section 25 and Section 35 of the Constitution, which in Section 25 sort of respecting the uniqueness of First Nation or Indian, Métis and Inuit rights in Canada, and Section 35 recognizing and affirming the existence of Aboriginal and treaty rights in Canada. So we're not done our work in terms of nation building, in terms of trying to understand what both of those sections mean. Some people say Section 35 is an empty box, that it's really, we're going to find out through negotiation or through court what the existing Aboriginal and treaty rights are of First Nations. And some people say that it's a full box. It's everything from the inherent right to self-government through to those sort of rights that are talked about in both historic and modern day treaty. But it's interesting that we do have sort of this convergence that's happening of a number of significant historic milestones as well as some modern day milestones in terms of moving us forward. I was reminded as I was thinking about this of this idea about Canada at a crossroads. And I think that's really true. We have, within our own institutions here in Canada, we have an ability to determine, to shape how we're going to live together in this country, how we're going to be mindful of each other, how we're going to recognize and respect each other's communities, each other's rights, each other's right to govern ourselves. We have the newly elected Trudeau government, who's talked about implementing all 94 recommendations from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Significantly, one of those recommendations is the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And it's the UN Declaration is incredibly far-reaching. Tom Flanagan, who's sort of a convenient naysayer on anything Indigenous, wrote an article that was published by the Globe and Mail a few days ago, which talked about if the Trudeau government embraced, as they claim they're going to, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, that basically the Canada's economy would come to a halt. We know that's not true. We know that there's certain folks out there, and Flanagan is one of those, who is a fearmonger and always tries to take sort of the darkest approach one could take in terms of talking about Indigenous peoples. But we also know that Indigenous people are interested in economy. They're interested in seeing their children prosper. They're interested in seeing their communities prosper. And they're interested in ideas of partnership, in terms of equity relationships, in terms of guiding how development would happen on their lands and in and around their own communities. But we also have, as part of that, sort of this larger project in terms of nation building itself. I remember a few years ago when I was working at the Assembly of First Nations, I was asked to attend an Indigenous Bar Association meeting out in Saskatchewan. And we were in the middle of negotiating the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. And so I thought that that's what I was being asked to speak about, because it was so topical and so current. And so staff at the AFN, maybe Sarah was one of those staff, helped prepare a really nice speech for me on the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. And when I got there and seen the program, it had me speaking about self-government. So I had this great speech, which was going to be kind of useless in terms of what was expected of me. So I did, much like some folks do on game shows, I dialed an elder and for some help. And one elder that I turn to most often is a gentleman by the name of Fred Kelly from Anigaming First Nation in northwestern Ontario. And so I phoned up Fred and I told him my dilemma. And he says, "Bob, you know about Google?" And Fred's a really high-tech elder. So I said, "You know, I'm kind of the Google master." And he goes, "Okay, well, Google Justice Williamson and put in Nishka, and you'll see this court case." And he said, "It's a really amazing court case." He says, it's from British Columbia. And what it was about was when one of the first modern treaties in Canada was being ratified. And it was recognizing the Nishka people and their government as an order of government in Canada. And it was being opposed by soon-to-be Premier Campbell and soon-to-be Attorney General for the government of BC, Penner, and who claimed that there is no room in Canada's constitution for a third order of government, that there was Section 91 laying out the powers of the federal government, Section 92 laying out the powers for the provincial government, and there was like no section that said, and here's where the Indigenous people are, here's where their government is. Maybe it's in that empty box called Section 35 of the Constitution, but it's nowhere that is explicit. So Justice Williamson heard this case, and what he concluded was that the Nishka Agreement was valid and that it should go forward. It was constitutionally correct. But importantly, what he talked a lot about federalism. And he said that federalism was a legal response to the underlying political and cultural realities that existed at the time of Confederation and continue to exist today. He said, at Confederation, political leaders told their respective communities that the Canadian Union would be able to reconcile diversity with unity. there was no Aboriginal people represented at the time of Confederation. Our leaders weren't there. Our governments weren't there. Our constitutions weren't represented at the time of Confederation. And what Justice Williamson said was that the inherent right to self-government, the indigenous right to self-government, was not something that the federal government had, and it was not something that the provincial government had. That it was something outside of their realm of authority. So they couldn't even speak to that at the time of Confederation. So there's this unfinished work, this unfinished business in terms of nation building in Canada to figure out, to reconcile the pre-existence of Indigenous sovereignty with the exertion of the sovereignty of the Crown in Canada. Justice Lamar in the famous Supreme Court decision Dalgamuk talked about that. And that's what he said. He said specifically, the reconciliation of the pre-existence of Aboriginal societies with the sovereignty of the Crown. He says, ultimately is through negotiated settlements with good faith and give and take on all sides that we can achieve this reconciliation. So reconciliation from the point of view of the Supreme Court isn't something new. It's not something that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has just dreamt up, or something that an ideal that we've imported from South Africa or anywhere else. It's been part of our fabric in Canada for some time, at times without the involvement of Indigenous people, just thinking about this ideal of reconciling diversity with unity, or reconciling unity with diversity. To me, is such a compelling principle and a foundation in terms of how to build society and how to build a nation. Unfortunately, up until perhaps the last 20 years or so, or maybe up until 1985, with changes to the Constitution Act, actually 82, up until that time, the Indigenous people of this country have been left out of that equation. So we have this unfinished work. In 2012, there's an important gathering in Ottawa called the Crown First Nation Gathering. And Governor General Johnson, he opened that gathering, and he was talking about the Royal Commission, or the Royal Proclamation. So this Royal Proclamation, again, 1763, kind of laid the foundation for the development of Canada, and actually the development of the United States as well. So the Governor General said, we have deep roots together of shared promise and partnership. This was reflected in the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which sought to achieve balance by allowing Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people to coexist and work together in the land we now call Canada. The Royal Proclamation predated Confederation by more than 100 years and is the foundation of our modern relationship. So we have this proclamation. A lot of Indigenous people refer to it as our Magna Carta in terms of recognition of Indigenous people as nations in this land. And we've gone through sort of this regression in terms of relationship between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people and what's now known as Canada, of talking about nations and nation-to-nation relationship, to talking about tribes, to talking about bands, to talking about communities, and sort of this devolution in terms of regression in terms of respect from non-Aboriginal people towards our own governments. And it's ironic, as John Ralston Saul, in his book A Fair Country, he talks about all the institutions that we take for granted here in Canada, sort of our liberal democratic framework, and a lot of ideals that go into everything from our justice system to multiculturalism to how we think about ourselves in terms of neighbors, how we think about ourselves in terms of equality, in particular equality of men and women. And what he said was that many of these ideals that we almost take for granted now, they weren't brought here from England, or they weren't brought here from France, or they weren't brought here from the Netherlands. That many of those things were discovered here. They were found here in terms of the societies and cultures and nations that were operating here in North America, and in our, for our purposes in particular, for Canada. the U.S. Constitution, and every president of the United States has acknowledged this, large parts of the U.S. Constitution were framed on the Iroquoian Constitution. The one thing they left out in terms of their constitution that Iroquoian people have in their constitution is one of the objectives of coming together as nations and into a nation state was peace. So the United States left peace out of their equation and tried to think of what a different world it might be if peace was one of the cornerstones in terms of the U.S. Constitution, but it's not there. So we have this royal proclamation that set up the treaty relationship in Canada. One of the things that Saul talked about is he said, we are a people of Aboriginal inspiration organized around a concept of peace, fairness, and good government. That is what lies at the heart of our story, at the heart of the Canadian mythology, whether Francophone or Anglophone. So a people of Aboriginal inspiration. So we have that. We have these amazing roots with each other, and we've gone down this journey that took us to philosophies and policies of things like kill the Indian within the child, and talking about not stopping until all Indians had been absorbed into the body politic, and which set up 150 or more years of what Beverly McLaughlin, Paul Martin, and now the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has called cultural genocide. This is our history of the last 150 years, from the opening of the first residential school in the early 1800s to the last school closing in 1996. It's not ancient history. A lot of times when people look at indigenous issues, they say, oh, well, that happened way back when. We're not responsible for what our forefathers did. The last school closed in 1996. The intergenerational impact, the legacy of residential schools, the pathologies that we see in far too many indigenous communities in Canada are a direct result of that century and a half of abuse, of cultural genocide, where residential schools were sort of the centerpiece in terms of a way of thinking about treatment of Indigenous people in this country. And this has been helped, actually, by a lot of our own education institutions. When Peter Bryce, who worked for the Department of Health in Canada in 1922 or 23, forget the year, wrote his famous paper, A National Crime, which talked about the rates of illness and the death rate in residential schools in Canada, and was subsequently fired because he wouldn't retract his paper. We didn't see this sort of outcry from institutions across Canada talking about the unfairness in terms of the treatment of Bryce. Actually, there's been an interesting study that was done as part of the work of the TRC of how many universities in Canada spoke with any sort of outrage about the treatment of Indigenous people through residential schools. How many PhDs flowed from this paper, A National Crime? How many dissertations flowed from that? How many health studies looked at the treatment of Indigenous children? Zero. Zero. So whether it's this university, whether it's McGill, whether it's University of Toronto or any other university in Canada, there is no sort of dialogue. There is no ability to talk about the sort of things that we're able to talk about, I think, with a lot more freedom now. Whether it was part sort of the cultural context of people at the time, sort of just to think, oh, the federal government's taking care of that and that's over there and we're over here, or whether it just wasn't important enough, I don't know. And I don't want to make any assumption on that, but the outcome is unchanged, regardless of the reason. There was no outcry. I was reading this U.S. history book that was published in 1987, and maybe this sort of helps set the context for what the TRC talks about is the need for us to think about each other differently and to look at each other differently. And that becomes kind of the framework of the foundation for reconciliation. A lot of this is individual work. So this U.S. history book, a secondary school history book, said for thousands of centuries, centuries in which humankind were evolving, forming communities, and building the beginnings of national civilizations in Africa, Asia, and Europe, America stood empty of mankind and its works. Europeans in the New World is a story of the creation of a civilization where none existed. So that's the type of thing that we've all been exposed to, whether it's through history books, whether it's through movies, whether it's through, you know, John Wayne being sort of this historical interpreter for all of us. But that's what we've been exposed to, both as indigenous people and non-indigenous people in this country. So we have a lot of kind of decolonizing to do and a lot of deconstructing of the way that we think of each other and a lot of constructing in terms of how we might move forward together. So I don't want to go into a whole bunch in terms of providing examples of how that book was wrong, but, you know, any sort of cursory stroll through a library would find all kinds of examples of the existence of civilizations in North America, Central America, and South America that prove that history book is a lie. So we've gone through this chapter, this dark chapter of our history. And there was an antecedent to it, too, before residential schools, because to me that's really kind of the epitome of how we've treated each other. There was industrial schools. Most of the industrial schools were in or around indigenous communities. But one of the complaints about industrial schools was that, and this was what people actually said, they said the wigwam was stronger than the classroom. So what they were saying, in effect, was all the good work that was being done through the day in terms of Christianization and aggressive acculturalization of indigenous people was being undone when these children were going home at night to their loving parents, to their siblings, to their extended family. And so the key to aggressive assimilation and the key to Christianizing these children was to remove them from the influence of their families. And out of that, really, the residential school system was born. People as young as 3 years old were taken away from their families and moved sometimes thousands of miles away. We had one of the first residential schools in Canada right next door to where I live in Brantford, Ontario. And there was children there from the James Bay Coast and Hudson Bay Coast and northern Quebec, northern Saskatchewan. So imagine that in the 1800s, early 1900s, the likelihood of being able to see your child on any sort of regular basis was almost non-existent. We're talking about poor, poor families and little infrastructure in terms of transportation. High, high rate of death at most schools. You look at the architectural designs of residential schools, most of them incorporated a graveyard into the architectural design. So the assumption was kids would die there. In some instances, and in some decades, the death rate at residential schools was around 50%. And some people have taken advantage of this and sort of saying that 50% of all the indigenous children that went to residential school died. That's just not true. But there were decades, and there were particular schools where there was a 50% death rate. But even thinking of that, thinking about a 2% death rate at a school is kind of astounding. It's hard to imagine, but sort of assuming that maybe there is some sense of normalcy that there would be a death rate at any school just seems incredibly ironic and destructive. And so we have this guy, Duncan Campbell Scott, who headed up this system. People appealed to him, teachers appealed to him, churches appealed to him to release more money so that kids would have better food at these schools, that schools would be repaired so that in the wintertime winds wouldn't sort of blow through the school and kids would get sick. And he basically turned a deaf ear on all of those requests. His objective was to kill the Indian and the child. and not to stop until Indians have been absorbed into the body politic. That was what he did. During that time, he sent his daughter away to a boarding school, either in Switzerland or France, I can't remember which, and she died at that boarding school. And he was so distraught, he could barely function as superintendent of Indian Affairs. But for some reason, he didn't have the ability to see that those same feelings that he was having was being experienced by indigenous families from one end of the country to the other. That in some of our languages, the word for child means something like the reason for our existence or the center of our existence. And the reason for our existence was being taken away. Some of the elders talk about there was no more laughter in the communities because so many children were gone. So the devastating impact on the communities, the types of violence that were perpetrated against children in these institutions, sexualized violence, other forms of violence, is still being played out in terms of legacies and intergenerational impact of residential schools. So we have a lot of work to do. We have this project in terms of nation building with still a lot of unfinished work, but we also have a lot of healing to do, both in Indigenous communities, and I would say healing in terms of our body politic in Canada as well. Canada has been hurt by its actions. We're told in a number of court cases that the honor of the Crown is at stake in terms of the Crown's treatment of Indigenous peoples in Canada. So it's interesting to me that it's the Crown and not the government, because the Crown, I mean, we sort of elect people to be government, but the Crown sort of sits at a little bit higher level, has a bit different stature, and in terms of spirit, it's intended to represent the spirit of Canada. So the honor of that spirit is at stake in terms of the treatment of Indigenous people. And that spirit is reflective of each and every one of us. We're all part of that. And one of the things I've heard far too many times in terms of my work in Ottawa was the relative unimportance of Indigenous issues. I couldn't count how many times members of Parliament said to me either one of two things. Bob, if there's just one thing that we could do to make things better, what would that one thing be? Or, you know, if your issues were just had some importance for my constituency, I would be more aggressive or more assertive about those issues. But your issues really aren't important to my constituency. And I understand that. I understand sort of the importance of healthcare and education and infrastructure and all those things as being important. And maybe Indigenous issues end up being like number 5, number 6, or number 10 for people. But that's not an excuse in terms of how the Crown operates, how the honor of the Crown becomes manifest through the work of government. It's not an excuse that it's not important enough for constituents. It's not an excuse for MPs to say, I'm not going to work on this, because the honor of the Crown's at stake in terms of that. In 2008, then Prime Minister Harper apologized for the treatment of Aboriginal peoples in residential school. He said those words in terms of a framework for residential schools to kill the Indian and the child. He talked about people being deprived of family, being deprived of language, being deprived of culture. And he apologized. And I was in the House of Commons that day. And I've talked to people who sat on the floor of the House of Commons and witnessed that apology. And I think there was a lot of sincerity in that apology. I had a chance to work on it a bit as part of the heading the team that was setting up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So I know some of the work that went into it. And I know the work that then Prime Minister Harper did in terms of rewriting some of the work that bureaucrats did and sitting down with survivors to get input in terms of making sure that he was saying some of the right things. The great failure of any apology is that there's no actions that manifest the sentiment of the apology. The worst thing about an apology is having to apologize twice for the same thing because you didn't do anything about what you were apologizing for in the first instance. And so what we've seen since 2008 is kind of a track record of not doing a whole lot in terms of manifesting that apology. I know that there is a senior team of bureaucrats that were pulled together right across government, and their task was, what can we do as a government to make the apology that the Prime Minister gave real? And so ideas were generated, like maybe we could name national parks after dead Indians, or have this, you know, beautiful stained glass in the House of Commons, and there is some beautiful stained glass in the House of Commons, sort of representative of the residential school era. But in terms of actually doing some real things to improve lives of Indigenous people, or to talk about how, as a country, we rethink our relationship with each other and how we move forward together, none of that happened. And so now we have this opportunity again. And I'd say, you know, one of the things that I see is this incredible patience from Indigenous people across this country for Canada to wake up, to act in a generous fashion with the Indigenous people here, the same sort of generosity that we try to show to other peoples and other countries around the world, but to think about that in terms of what we need to do here. This, in the United States, the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, he apologized for his agency's legacy of racism and inhumanity that included massacres, relocations, and the destruction of Indian languages and cultures. And he said, by accepting this legacy, we also accept the moral responsibility of putting things right. So I think that's one of our challenges now. It's one thing to apologize, or even one thing to accept some responsibility for what happened. So that sort of backward glance, that affirmation that bad things were done, is important. But equally important, or maybe even more important, is what sort of path do we chart together in terms of our future? This idea of this moral responsibility of putting things right. Former Governor General Michel Jean talked about this as an opportunity of rethinking and rebuilding our nation. She said that's what reconciliation was, is that opportunity. And my own sense is that reconciliation is going to happen on a number of levels. I think a lot of the things that the Prime Minister has talked about in terms of implementing all 94 recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I think a number of those will happen. I don't think all 94 are going to be implemented during this mandate. But I think that there will be energy put into all of those. And putting energy into something is important. It's going to change the way government institutions look at their responsibilities. It's going to change relationships in terms of how we can respect each other. And these changes are going to be profound. Having an Indigenous Minister of Justice is going to have profound consequences, I think, for Canada. The black hats of the Department of Justice have always been perhaps the biggest stumbling block in terms of thinking of new ways of moving ahead, in terms of thinking about rights in a different way, in terms of thinking about the place of the inherent right to self-government in this constitutional framework that we're all part of. So I think those black hats in the Department of Indian Affairs will probably start wearing gray hats or something sometime pretty soon, and change some of their colors. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, as I said, has made recommendations for all of us. It made recommendations for post-secondary institutions in terms of the types of programming that we can offer, in terms of indigenizing the content and the method of delivery of material, about making these institutions a more welcoming place for Indigenous people, of calling upon the ministers of education from across the country to work with Indigenous people in terms of a whole new way of thinking about telling the story of the history of Canada. The importance of talking about, in some cases, making Indigenous history courses or like an Indigenous 101 mandatory. Some universities have already done that. Some universities have apologized for the fact that they were training those people that ran residential schools and ran the child welfare authorities that scooped so many thousands of our children away from their communities and their families. So there's work for each and every one of us. And I don't think that all of the work is going to take place on Parliament Hill, where Prime Minister Trudeau and National Chief Bellegarde and maybe some of the other national leaders have some big hug fest, and then we end up with some sort of trickle-down reconciliation that we all sort of feel really good about and maybe sing Kumbaya together or something, I'm not sure. I think there's actually a lot of work to be done. I think that decolonizing some of the ways that we think about each other is hard work. I think even finding ways of thinking about each other in a new and refreshing way is going to be hard work. Michelle Jean urged us. She said this is, she talked about this refoundation, but she said this has to happen in our history. We need to come together and we need to confront history together. She said in one way or another, we have all been dispossessed. Aboriginal peoples have been dispossessed of their languages, their cultures, their dignity, dispossessed of the precious bonds between generations, dispossessed of handing down ancestral knowledge, dispossessed of an ancient heritage. Words will allow the truth to come out to overcome the disregard and ignorance of this tragic episode of our collective history. So this is part of our challenge. And one of the things that I've seen, I get a chance to meet folks from all over the country to speak at different events, and I'm actually quite hopeful in terms of the opportunity for reconciliation to become a vehicle, to become the impetus for this rethinking of our nation and how the different constituent parts of our country work together. And I've seen glimmers of great hope in every part of the country that I've spoken. And I think there's a lot of really small individual acts that are going to happen. I remember working with a colleague who told me he was a third-generation residential school survivor. His grandparents went to residential school. His parents went to residential school. He went to residential school. And Monday morning, we were sitting around having coffee, and he said, Bob, he said, amazing thing happened on the weekend. He said, I told my daughter that I loved her. And I said, oh, well, that's great. Sort of thinking to myself, what's the big deal? And he said, that was the first time that I'd done that. I said, really? He goes, yeah. He says, no one ever told me that they loved me when I was a kid. I was raised in an institution. He said, I didn't know that was part of the deal. He said, so I told her I loved her. At least that was the first time. And to me, that's reconciliation. And there's going to be thousands and thousands of these sort of little tiny reconciliations. And they all have energy, and they all have power, and they all have a force, and they all have the ability to affect change, whether it's change in terms of the way we think or the way we feel about each other or ourselves. They're all positive. And all these little tiny reconciliations, I think, are going to
become a force of change in our country. In this call to action, and there's coffees out on the table there, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission talked about the need. Laws must change, policies, programs must change, the way we educate our children and ourselves must change, the way we do business must change, thinking must change, the way we talk to and about each other must change. All Canadians must make a firm and lasting commitment to reconciliation to ensure that Canada is a country where our children and grandchildren can thrive. And I think of nothing else in terms of what we have in common. I think all of us want a better future for our children and our grandchildren. And if there's nothing else, I mean, Constitution aside, TRC aside, UN Declaration aside, if there's nothing else that might become a driver or a foundation in terms of how we think about each other and how we move forward together, it might be to build a better place or to leave this place better off for those that are going to inherit it, our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. I know I'm a little bit over time and want some time for questions and answers, but I just wanted to say a couple other things. I was at a workshop on reconciliation a couple months ago in Hamilton. And one of the survivors that was there, she's a good friend of mine, she talked about what she was feeling from the people in the room. And she said, oftentimes when we talk about this dark chapter in our history, there's this false guilt and false shame that ends up becoming a barrier to moving together. And what she said to the people there, and I think that's true with just about anywhere we end up talking about this, she said, it wasn't any of you people that ran the residential school, and it wasn't any of you people that abused the children there. So having this false guilt or false shame isn't really helpful in terms of how we think about each other and how we think about a future together. That a false sense of guilt or a false sense of shame aren't a good foundation. That we need to have a more positive framework and a more positive paradigm in terms of working together. It's true that a lot of institutions in Canada, both churches and government, did shameful things. They did evil things. And some of the people that worked there did that. But there's a lot of really good people that worked in those institutions too. But, so as much as those institutions did some bad things, as individuals and as a collectivity in this country, trying to build a future together on guilt or shame isn't a future. When we set up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and this was one of the controversial pieces, one of the things we put in there in terms of the terms of reference for the TRC was that it was not a name and shame and blame institution. Because naming, shaming, and blaming aren't foundations for moving ahead. And people were critical of us for setting up the TRC that way. But that's the way it was set up. It was set up to help provide this bright light in terms of shining a light on our past, but also shining a light in terms of a way forward, in terms of how we move forward together. Paul Chartrand, who is an amazing academic scholar and diplomat, Métis man from Saskatchewan, he told us when we were setting up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that truth commissions are like spring ice, or like fall ice that we're experiencing now. That sometimes you go out in the morning and maybe in a puddle or in a pond, there's this really thin layer of ice, and it's really fragile. And if you just try to grab it, it's going to crumble in your hand. But maybe if you get quite a few hands together and you pick it up, you can keep it whole. And you hold up the light, and there's this beautiful spectrum of colors that get released and shine their beauty on all of us. And he says that's what's required to hold up the TRC. And I think that's equally true in terms of holding up the call to action that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has given to every one of us. It's going to take a lot of our hands working together to hold up these calls to action so that that beauty and that light and that way forward is made manifest to all of us. And we end up finding a place for each and every one of us, our families, our communities, our organizations, the various groups that we